my pack along the
way. Shall we go? Sure. All right. Welcome to Barnstorming. This is Taylor Lightman, co-host, co-producer, and as always, you know him, you love him. My co-producer, Jordy Comas. Drum roll, please.
You've really gotten that down.
Co-owner, co-friend.
Yeah, I think Taylor, you're the exclusive director of creative marketing and retail products. After looking at some of the stuff we've got in the pipeline,
just to tease it here, we're coming out with a Barnstorming PA store soon, so you can get your Barnstorming PA merchandise. This will help fund our operation here, and looking forward to it.
Someday we dream of not losing money.
Yeah.
Or we dream of someday not losing money. So yes, I'm Jordy Comas. Wear many hats. We have a guest who's been a friend for a very long time, and I'm proud to say my county commissioner for a shorter period of time. So we'll turn it over to Stacy and let her introduce herself. Stacy? Oh. Commissioner Richards, sorry.
It's so nice to be here, Taylor and Jordy. You really do a great service here, and I enjoy the podcasts. I like that they're taped, that I can go to them anytime, and I have. So we have been friends for quite some time. The work that you do is really important. I know you know, but maybe not everybody listening knows that I'm a new commissioner. I was elected 2 years ago. I'm halfway through my first term. I have a background in government. I was born on Abe Lincoln's birthday. I'm not going to take you the whole way back to my birth. It's just important to me because I was thinking about, and I think many times, why is it that for my professional life, I've been involved in government, either working in government or working with government. And it does go back to Abe Lincoln. I took a special interest in, and you know, he was a great president, took a special interest in the federal government. I was young at the time, but John Kennedy was president, and you know, we all came together and we got to the moon, and you know, the whole thing, and the Peace Corps started, and it was just, the sense was, and the belief was, that government, when it works well, and working well means, you know, cooperation and civility and engagement by people at all levels of government, including residents locally, we can do great things. So I stuck with that. And I was a political science major at Bucknell University. Went to Washington, spent 12 years there in government, as well as working with Congress as head of government affairs for a large, well, actually the engineering firm. So transportation and public works and the environment are not new to me at all. Went up to Boston and had to put my knowledge to work on a massive project up there, the Big Dig, to take it from planning through the environmental review and permit process. And what I learned during that, one of the things I learned during that, was that the best thing to do is to just not cause a problem in the first place. Prevent it. Design it out. And this speaks very much, I'm sure, Taylor, to your sustainability and climate change. You know, let's do that. So I learned that, and Boston is an absolutely terrific city after a massive public works project that really could have ruined it, but didn't. And so when I got back to Pennsylvania, because I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, Governor Ridge had taken office, and he was starting a new deputate in the Department of Environmental Protection called Pollution.
Did you just use the word deputate?
Yes.
I don't know that word.
Oh, okay.
Well, what is a deputate?
Neither did I. Well, you...
I'm focusing on the most important details.
That's right. DEP has about five different deputates. One of them is the coal and gas. Another is water. Another is air. And they're the big programs. You know, so I became a deputy secretary. And my new deputate, whole new realm for DEP, was pollution prevention and compliance assistance, exactly what I was doing on the Big Dig, which is design it out. And so my job, my small job, was to change the culture of our businesses and residents and local governments throughout Pennsylvania, as well as change the culture of DEP itself to begin to move away from managing pollution once it's occurred to avoiding pollution, and in the process become much more friendly and with all who are regulated, and to help with this process. It was a really big, tall order, but a number of things still hold with that. I think the DEP is much more of a partner, sometimes too much of a partner, with the private sector and municipal governments. But I also inherited, I was the director of energy in that role for Pennsylvania. So I inherited the energy office. It used to be under the lieutenant governor, and they were specialists. So they taught me all about energy efficiency and renewable energy, which I then carried back to Lewisburg when I came back here in 2003 and established the Energy Resource Center at City Council of Governments, and ran it for 14 years, and then ran for county commissioner. So I focused a lot on energy efficiency, just reduce the amount of use that we use, save money in the process, build new industries. And at the same time, I studied the economics of what is the best use, how can our local governments, our local communities, particularly in rural Pennsylvania, be able to re-energize themselves economically through energy. And what I found in looking all over the country and doing work with municipalities is that the best thing to do is first to use less energy efficiency, not using as much energy because you've weatherized your home and you've thought about your energy use. But then when you move into renewable energy, the place to be is you own it and you use it. So did a number of projects. Could talk about that forever, but I don't think that you want to talk about that. But yeah, that's my background. Somewhere back in the mid 80s, I was still in DC. I was accepted at Harvard to their public administration program.
Hold on. I don't know if you should admit that on a podcast about rural people.
That's very true. In this area, that might not be a good idea. That really Although, makes me an elite, doesn't it?
Do you know do you have that in common with another luminary of Pennsylvania politics? You know who?
Pennsylvania politics. Well,
State level.
Don't know who.
Fetterman has a master's from Harvard.
Went too.
Yeah. Yeah, he has a master's of public policy or something like that.
Well,
before Bill he put O'Reilly, his dickies on.
Bill O'Reilly went too, but he quit.
Yeah, that I wouldn't consider him a luminary. What's the opposite of a luminary? He's a shadowary. Yeah. Nor is he really a political figure. He's a media figure. But anyway, I want to kind of pull out as I was listening, because I knew some of that story, but and this is kind of broader brushstrokes than maybe we meant to be, but it's interesting thinking about your career and, you know, not to be impolite, but like, you know, you're sort of a generation above me and Taylor's kind of a generation below me. So we've got kind of an interesting perspective on these issues and sort of the Kennedy piece. But it's like, I feel like old school liberals, and I don't mean you in particular, but I mean that mindset was very much right, especially around energy and pollution, right? Like, the role of the role of government is to stop the economy from doing bad things and to be like the heavy-handed arbiter. And then you talked in your career about kind of a different emergent approach, which I feel like lines up with sustainability, which is like, let's build partnerships. And in a sec, you can comment on that. But I feel like we're still in that world, right? We both things are still true. And that's what can be tricky about local governance, right? Like, I prefer partnerships, but it's also the case that they're economic actors, whether it's at a very local or a state or a federal or an international level, who need to be regulated. So it feels like your career kind of has both of those elements. But does that, you feel like there's been a shift in kind of like broadly on the left or liberals about like the role of government, you know, from seeing it like with my kids, for example? I got into this last night, but like, I feel like younger generations sometimes are like, yeah, you know, we need government to step in and fix things. And I'm a little bit like, government can really screw things up, right? And I have a very sort of dim view of government sometimes, even though I'm in it.
Well, one of the things what I learned when Obama was president was I took a look at his appoint appointees, and, you know, at the high level. And almost all of them were from urban areas. You know, I at the time was already here in central Pennsylvania, and I would sometimes feel that the urban perspective doesn't meet the urban or the rural very well, and that some of the policies that came down that kind of missed the mark may have been caused by that. But I've said to people many times, oh boy, you know, if I knew then what I know now about how hard it is at the local level to actually have change happen and to be able to get the cooperation that's required and how long it may take to be able to have good things happen. I would have been different as a policymaker at DEP or in DC. And I think everybody that is in the federal level should have some experience first at the local level. And I did it in reverse. I'm very glad I wouldn't do it differently, but I think it's kind of hard for people at the local level, particularly in rural areas, to be able to say move up and head into the national level. So it was a good way for me to have a really rewarding career. I have to say that now, you know, to answer your question though, Jordy, what's changed? I mean, for what I laid out in terms of government can do good things. And in return, you know, the flip side of it is it's very important that we have an engaged public. And I think when I was growing up, for me, what's changed is that women went into the workforce. And instead of a one income family, one paycheck family, now most are in the workplace. Now that's economics. We could talk about that too in a podcast about how that happened and just have a ball with that one. But that removed from civic engagement a lot of free but brilliant work done by women who wanted to do more than raise children and pretended to have the time to do it. And that's gone now. And I, to me, that's very noticeable. That's a big change. That's one of the changes that I'm noticing from the time that Kennedy was president.
So we're going to, sometimes we kind of end with sort of a fun, we call it our game or activity, but we're going to mix it up because sometimes we also get into heavy topics and it's sort of like, you know,
okay,
we're doing, so now we're going to do, so we're going to kind of like do a couple of sort of fun, slightly serious, slightly goofy questions. So one, and a lot of these are PA themes. So the first one is, and full disclosure, Stacey did see these ahead of time. So if her answers are over polished, we're going to ding you for being too much of a politician.
They're not going to be.
Favorite whoopie pie flavor?
Chocolate cookie, peanut butter icing.
That is popular.
That is polished. Yeah.
And I had whoopie pies when I was growing up in Western Pennsylvania because my grandfather came from York, in fact, was a Mennonite. So a lot of those things. And it would never have occurred to me to put peanut butter between those two cookies. Back then. But
have y'all ever heard of these alcohol infused whoopie pies?
No, but I'm surprised it took this long.
Yeah, no, it's for real. They maybe it's unpaved.
It may be the Mennonite roots of it. I had a funny experience this summer where I was in Maine and they were these people. We were kind of in a little, you know, not one of the bigger cities in air quotes in Maine. And there were like two places and it said Maine traditional whoopie pies. And I was like, what? No, that's a pencil. What do you, you know, come on. Like, it turns out there were some Mennonites who had come. And so in this little area of Maine, they considered it like their local thing. And they were like, well, maybe we're from. Yeah, they were like, maybe went from Maine to Pennsylvania. I was like, I don't think so. You could say that. That's a nice story, but I don't think so.
Did you try one?
No, because I don't love whoopie pies. They're too sweet.
Didn't have the right shortening in it.
Yeah. What makes you most excited to go to the Wednesday market?
Though this is a serious answer. Yeah, I love the connection.
This is dead serious for me.
Dead serious. Yeah, I haven't been to the market for a long time because of COVID, unfortunately. But my favorite is the connection between the shoppers and the local vendors and that are producing our food. So the food to table, I just love that. We are unique.
I saw Representative Kill. For me, recently, it's Hickory Run Farmstead, the Glicks family. They do amazing produce, and he's a great guy.
I like the dairy stand.
There's a couple.
The guy out in Sundary that has Perry Ross.
Yeah,
Perry's. He has the mocha milk and the chocolate milk. That's just super.
I don't remember the name of his cow, but because he and I talk to the farmers a lot, Stacy, but I forget the name of it. But whatever it is, it produces a higher fat content milk, which is why his milk is so.
I also have to say that guy that sells bread from Mifflinburg, he has great bread. Although I guess he was canceled.
don't say that. He decided to leave the market.
Did he John leave the Panuka? Market? Is that yeah. John Panuka?
Panenko. Yes, Panenko, he did.
Okay. He left the market? I feel like
we should definitely edit this out because this is very touchy. Me and some other people brought up the fact that he had the Goebbels sign and they asked him to take it down and then he left in a huff. And Keller came with some of his supporters a week ago and we're giving them a hard time about censoring free speech. Meanwhile, there's a guy who's selling Trump hats and Let's Go Brendan. And kudos to the market and the market manager because they really held the line. Some people tried to reach out to John. All of this is out. But I got into a big fighting match with Keller about his vote on election.
I heard there was somebody's like, yeah, somebody really laid into Keller at the market. I was like, I wonder who that
did you was. Really?
I heard that. Yeah.
That is hilarious.
Okay.
We're going to edit all that out because it's just too, not that right. I don't want to talk about it, but I wasn't ready for it.
It's not derailed.
Okay. So if you think about, Union County or the area, is there a place you'd love to go for the view, like best view?
No, one of the reasons I live here is because I just like driving on any of the roads and seeing the phenomenally fine fields, rolling hills, mountains. So
I love being at the market. Everything's fine. You are definitely getting points for polish. Yeah.
Have you ever considered higher office?
I don't mean to be polished.
I do have to say though, Union County, I have a tattoo of Union County. It is a truly, you can go anywhere and be really surprised and awestruck.
Fun fact, isn't your neighborhood called Gilead's Woods or something like that?
It's called Eichler Park.
Sorry, Tyler.
Yeah, it is.
Uh-huh. And do you watch The Handmaid's Tale?
I don't.
Okay, because that's the name of the theocratic fascist republic. So
you pointed that out.
Oh, sorry. All right. So last question. Does Parks and Rec, hoping that our audience have heard it, which is, now that I'm saying
seen
this.
It's a TV show.
It's a TV show about local government, municipal government, and the Parks and Rec Department. Does it help or hurt people's impressions about local government? So I'm very curious about your answer on this.
Well, I've only tuned into it a couple of times.
Okay.
And because I don't watch sitcoms, because I can't stand the laugh track. But what I did see is that it was a good show. How many shows do you have that shows government working, the people working together and being committed to it? Which the shows that I caught, I felt did. I love Amy Poehler. I think that she's one of the best, and there were a lot of good stars in the show. What I kind of, if there's, any negative to it, it's number one, we don't have more of them, more serious shows. But also, it is a comedy, and not everything we do is a comedy.
It is. I think I've not thought about this deeply, but I have watched a lot of the show. I hadn't thought, Stacey, that, and I mean this in the best way, you are a serious version of Leslie Knope a little bit, right? Like you love government, you've got the hair, Kennedy was your idol. I think about Ted, which is a show that Taylor and I have both seen. I think Parks and Rec and Ted are two comedies where there's
Ted Lasso.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of humor, but it's fundamentally about people trying to be nice and do the right thing, which is different than It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Breaking Bad is not a comedy. So ultimately, I do think it's kind of positive. It's got some great setups, right? The supervisor who's a libertarian, the Ron character is hilarious. But
yeah, I think the thing, and I've been working in a nonprofit, which is government adjacent for 6 months now. And it is, I do think it's interesting how much how hard it is to do seemingly simple things. And I think the vein in that is the point of satire that makes it click.
And also
great observation.
Yes. And also the way that not concerns that may not objectively seem very important have emotional weight for people. So it leads to a lot of people coming to meetings very concerned about things that do matter to them, but at one step removed can be a bit humorous. So let's move on to some substantive things. You've been a commissioner, and commissioners, if people don't know, I mean, I can't believe I'm going to say this because you should.
We've got three of them.
We've got three of them. They are kind of like a hybrid of a legislative function and executive function, right? They both create, we'll call them ordinances. Is that what they're called at the county level? Laws?
Well, we kind of try to stay away from ordinances because it requires, you know, if it backfires on you, you've got liability.
Okay.
But
you both pass policy and
manage the administration.
And manage policy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Which is different than I think a lot of us. That's not true, for example, for me on borough council, where we literally only do policy and then we, you know, have devolved to the manager execution. So you're more like township supervisors, that they have that dual role of making and implementing policy.
No? Well, I think this is a great thing to talk about. It goes back to me saying that, you know, I believe that government can do good. So that sort of tends me to be head towards activist government. And we could get into that in a bunch of different examples. Whereas that isn't kind of the mindset of many people around here. And I'll label it Republican. It is not a Republican mindset, usually, that less government is more or better or whatever, I think, is pretty much what most Republicans believe. Plays out.
I'm just going to I think the less and more government and activist or not, to be honest, I'm just going to throw this out. We can talk about it more, but like that's purely a function of the view of the person who's saying it, of their perspective of the legitimacy of the issue, right? People who say that they're less government, for example, with abortion, are quite happy to have a government that's very active about women's bodies.
Get the government's hands off my Medicare.
Yeah, or that classic phrase. So I think in general, if people really dig beneath that sort of surface, what they want is effective government or not, right?
Well, what I found is that is a fascinating part of my job, though, because a lot of what my colleagues, commissioner colleagues, we agree on a lot of things. We often agree on them for different reasons. And what I have found, generally speaking, is that the root of it is I believe in activist government. I think that we as commissioners can do a lot as leaders and have influence over the within the county beyond what we traditionally have. That is not really and is pretty much the bedrock perspective that my Republican colleagues come from. So I guess maybe it just happens to be that it's, you know, in the county commissioner's boardroom that this plays out. But but I'm not really sure, because I think, you know, I'm just thrilled by it. We have very rich discussions. There's a lot of civility among us, and we listen to each other. And I've learned a lot from them. And I hope they've learned a lot from me. But what I found is, because of the discussions that we have, we often change we don't change. We do a better job of governing. You know, we have thought about things from more than one angle or two angles. We've thought about them from three. And I'm sure that I've been challenging to them and insisting that we talk about certain things or come at it from a point of view that they hadn't considered before. And my background in government has really come in handy there. And I feel like I very much enriched our government, and I give them credit too. It's been except for very few exceptions, it's been a great experience.
Yeah, so Commissioner Richards, so we're going to start by asking you some questions about, and we're going to try and do this relatively quickly, but obviously there's room for elaborations. Just a couple questions on, you know, you're halfway through your first term here. Term is 4 years, and I guess you're 2 years in. Just sort of some stuff that's happened. And I know a lot of probably your initial plans of what you wanted to do were sidelined by the pandemic that came in essentially immediately. But I know that y'all have been hard at work on a number of other priorities. So I guess the first being, you know, something that I'm really passionate about is sustainability, which I'll define as energy efficiency for just, you know, simply. So if you want to just say...
You just froze on me. You just froze on me. I'm sorry. Okay. I couldn't hear what you said. Energy efficiency, and then the next word was simplicity.
Yeah. So we'll just say for simplicity, if you wanted to talk about what you've been able to do sustainability wise, and by that we mean energy efficiency.
Okay. It's been ongoing. When I was at the Energy Resource Center, I procured for Union County commissioners at the time and a comprehensive energy audit of all of their buildings. There are four or five. And much to my delight, they immediately turned it over to their maintenance manager, and they embedded the recommendations because some of them cost money. Not all of them did, but they embedded it into our ongoing maintenance plan of the buildings, and have just saved an enormous amount of money and a tremendous amount of pollution because they started that about 8 years ago. And they're almost done. So that was a big deal. And we talk about it a bit, you know, could we do more? You know, of course, and of all the things that there are to talk about, I think this is the one that, you know, as it seems to always do, got sidetracked a little bit. But the conservation district run by the county does a lot in terms of, to a certain extent, energy efficiency that goes broader than that, stormwater management, pollution to the bay, assistance to agriculture. For energy efficiency, we are now asking our program directors to really question whether or not they really need to replace the vehicle when it's time to replace it. And if they do, to purchase energy efficient vehicles. And off the top of my head, beyond that, at least in terms of the county, those are probably the key things, Taylor. And this is your shtick, so I'm very much looking forward to meeting with you soon and being able to learn about what you learned and studied to see how we might be able to work together. I know you're now doing some work for Lewisburg Borough. But for all the years I've been involved with energy, I've known but I've sensed how complex it is, and I've always felt that this is one of the issues that must be driven. It must have commitment from the very top in Congress and in the executive branch. And without that, we're going to get a little ways, but we're not going to get as far as we need to go.
Yeah. Could you say a little bit more about some of the work that the Conservation and Soil District is doing on flood mitigation and stormwater management?
Well, you know that we've got a lot of agriculture, and so, and the Chesapeake Bay, we have a commitment to be able to make sure that that's clean. So, geez, half of the staff, and they're probably six staff every day, are working with farmers to introduce best management practices. So what used to be tilled fields or turned over plowed fields every spring mostly aren't now. So the runoff is not there into the streams. That doesn't have that much to do with energy. But what does have to do with energy is a lot of the trees remain so that for floodplain management, the trees are there. We're not turning over the dirt. We're able to be much more effective in keeping the groundwater, you know, turning it into groundwater as opposed to stormwater.
For sure.
We also have, just to, not to belabor this, but last year, the commissioners agreed to, at the request of Department of Environmental Protection, undertake a county action plan to work with both with neighborhoods, with local governments, with farmers, to be able to, again, a lot of it is stormwater management and water pollution and manure management and whatnot. But it's also an opportunity to be taking a look at our local ordinance around green buildings, for example, energy efficient buildings, do we really need large parking lots? Do we really need to pave over all of them? And which provides a really good opportunity for, those of us who aren't farmers to examine our own practices. Can we have rain gardens, when we're doing landscaping, that kind of stuff.
I really like the, I don't know who, this might be an Elizabeth Warren thing, or it might just be in the zeitgeist, is we need systems change to combat climate change. I like that a lot. And I think there's a lot to unpack with that. Jordy, are you, do you want to ask the broadband question?
No. Sorry, I had to go get the battery charger and there was this snarl of cable. So
okay.
If you saw me moving around, it's because I was trying to untangle seven cables.
For sure. Well, then I'll go ahead and ask about COVID and then you can do your two in just a sec. So Stacey, cool. So, and we do that just so we can see the audio spike later so we can find the spot. So Stacey, quickly into your term, the whole world was sort of derailed by the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm wondering if you could talk quickly about what you have been able to do in your role as county commissioner to mitigate this crisis.
I would say that the county commissioners as a whole have been responsive to the recovery and less responsive as a county leader in the reduction in spread of COVID. And that probably is the place where I have diverged the most from the county commissioners, my colleagues. And I viewed activist government, I viewed it from a risk management point of view. And let's try to contain this, stop it. Let's try to prevent it, the worst part of it, as opposed to manage it after it happens. But at the same time, we worked really, really well together in being able to take the dollars that began to flow almost immediately. They came to the county for us to disperse, to try to help, from a public health, but most importantly, from an economic perspective, not-for-profits and businesses. So, and broadband. We got $2.5 million by May of 2020. And by September, we had distributed all of it. We put immediately $1 million into broadband. And then the $2.5 million, we did what I think we get praised for, a very good application process to be able to identify need and distribute $1.5 million in funding to about 150 organizations and businesses just within the county. Did the same thing in the fall, or last year, I guess, for the hospitality community or businesses. About $500,000 came down to the county, and we were able through CEDACOG to be able to, again, with an awards, with an application, be able to distribute it to, of the 21 businesses in Union County that applied for the funds, we were able to get funding to 19 of them because they qualified for it. So
is that the hospitality
those
industry?
Are some of the big responses to COVID, but in addition, our emergency management agency was active from the get-go. And, again, responsive as opposed to preventative, did a lot of handing out of PPE equipment, making sure emergency management services are, ambulances, our schools, our hospitals, everybody had access to some good masks and cleansers and that sort of thing. But we're about, if you don't mind me jumping into ARPA now, there's more to come. There's a lot of money out there that we didn't get as a county, but went to Community Action Agency on helping residents with of lower income, you know, to be able to get rent relief, mortgage relief, utility bill relief, going forward, not just behind or now, but even going forward. Millions of dollars came poured into our county for that, and it's, some of it is still there. But we're about to get, well, we've gotten half of it so far, more than $8 million in the legislation that was passed last year, the American Rescue Plan Act. And we have 4 million now. We'll get another 4 million probably in June. And just last week, because it's complex and it's a lot of money, and it went to every municipality, every county based on population, it's complex in terms of the rules of the road for what you can spend the money on, 400 pages of guidance. So I do believe, based on the conversation that we commissioners had last week, that we will be, again, doing an awards and application process to be able to put a lot of the money back out to the community to be able to help with economic recovery and with public health. We also have the opioid settlement that's coming. We just were awarded $1 million, which we'll get within a couple of months, that we can really be focusing on what's happened to our community because of drug abuse, drug overdose, the stresses. So I've been pushing a lot for, let's get as much as we can out to the community. Let's ask the community for feedback. Let's not pretend that we three commissioners know exactly what we should be doing for the community. And I think that is what you'll see unfolding. You'll hear a lot more about it.
Yeah, but Brian, go ahead. I am curious, like, how do you think that we can use this money, which is, you know, could be a once in a generation type of influx in capital? How do we use this to be transformative?
It's a good question, you know, because as I have been reading the interim rule as well as the real rule, and this at the time when this legislation was passed, the focus was on economic recovery and on...
Sorry, are you talking ARPA or opioid money now?
I'm talking about ARPA, American Rescue Plan dollars. Mm-hmm. Economic recovery from COVID, continuing to try to mitigate the health risks of COVID as well as move beyond them. So to be transformative, and thirdly, it was hopefully to be able to see long-term gain from the money, and that speaks to I believe the transformationness of it. So we have a number of nonprofits out there that do a lot of work in our community, great work, and a lot of organizations that are quasi-public agencies. And they have been collecting data and developing needs analyses and studies for years. And to me, this is the opportunity for them to pull them out, brush them off. They have the data and be able to use that to be able to then submit for funding and hopefully be transformative. You know, it's transformative action. I think that the commissioners are going to, as they evaluate, you know, not $8 million is actually not even close to meeting the needs of our recovery, or what didn't get done or what got dropped or the bad things that have happened because of COVID. And how do we recover from those, whether it's monetary or services? I believe that we are going to wait the applications that we get, and we're going to ask what is going to be the transformative opportunity here. You know, how many people, or in what way do you think this will impact the community for the long term? So those are questions not usually asked, but we have the opportunity to ask them. We should be asking them. And I think that that's how we'll proceed.
If I could, you know, I'm not sure if I'm pushing back or just helping you to elaborate, but like, to me, like ARPA and then whatever happens with the physical infrastructure bill that passed this year, and there's a lot of waves of money here we're talking about. So I know it can get confusing, but anyway, both with ARPA and the need to fix the problems and like the physical infrastructure bill and hopefully whatever happens with Build Back Better, you know, to me, and I feel like infrastructure is getting a little bit of a bad name, but it's related to the transformational piece. And to me, it's a set of resources that are best developed and curated by government or community actors, and whose value increases the economic performance of everybody around them, right? And whose value is hard to price in a market. So for example, you know, roads is a classic example, but I think the internet, it works pretty well. Technology, I'm going to say, like, thinking about what I know about our area, saying to like the existing players in our area, what's your idea for transformational change? The things we may need may not come through that process, right? Like, this is a moment maybe where government and in partnership with other counties needs to be able to think bigger, because there may not be the nonprofit like to do the thing that needs to happen with transportation infrastructure, or to do the thing that needs to happen with opioid, or to do the thing that needs to happen with local, you know, trade and community education. So does that make sense as a question, right? Like, simply saying to the community, give us your grants, they may not have the capacity to propose and manage transformational change.
They may not, but then again, we don't have that much money. And I had hoped that the Build Back Better legislation would pass, because in my view, the ARPA legislation just set up the opportunity to be able to then continue on with the transformative, particularly on the human services side. We did get the infrastructure bill. The infrastructure bill, lots of money, but half of it was money that traditionally comes through anyways, through authorization bills for airports and roads and whatnot.
Also, over 10 years, which I feel like got missed in a lot. It drives me crazy when media are like, it's $87 trillion, whatever the big number is to scare people. I'm like, over 10 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. And you know, some of the, how that money is going to come down, that extra money, that other half, is still not clear. But it's going to the state. And, you know, we've got CEDACOG here for all of our counties. They do a great job in helping us come to the table and get the projects funded that need to be funded. A lot of money is going to go to public transportation, to airports. You know, that's kind of not hitting us. But the really good thing about, there are many good things about the infrastructure bill. It's just, it's too new to really know what the details are going to be on how we can use it. But, you know, one could say that we build out the interstate highway system and we created a monster. We created urban sprawl. We created all sorts of things. So it was really transformative, that's for sure. But what the infrastructure bill does include, and I don't think it had been included in the term infrastructure before, is broadband. You know, we knew already that we had to address broadband and bring it to the underserved and the non-served, particularly in the western and northern portions of Union County. It's expensive. Broadband's expensive, which is a reason why the service providers didn't put it in. And it's up to us to do it. So, you know, the $1 million that we spent on broadband was critically important because of all, well, we know, it just heightened the critical nature of it. We had to put money into broadband. And we built out an infrastructure by giving the $1 million to an organization called Drive, who pulled five counties together to be able to do the microwave technology, the beaming from tower to tower. But we also are investing through CEDACOG, received a grant that they were working on even before I became commissioner, but has come to fruition while I've been here, that will bring $1 million of investment into our county to install fiber cable, which is really the gold standard for going forward. Absolutely no cost at all to government or the taxpayers. That's phenomenal. We will have, we're told, more money for broadband, but it's not easy, because I believe that this is something just like, you know, electricity way back when, you know, beginning of the last century, didn't get out to the rural areas. And so it came out because the federal government made it come out. They foot the bill for a lot of it. And I'm thinking that we're going to need to see the same thing. We certainly can't afford to just pay for it ourselves, or should we?
The total cost here is for Union County? Like, if we just had broadband everywhere, is...
Oh, you know, I'm not really sure that we've ever calculated that. But if you figure that if we did fiber optics, which we need to do, I mean, the microwave stuff is a Band-Aid, as the data, you know, packages increase, you've got 5G and not 3G, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be fiber optics, that the fiber cable that's going to carry that. And right now, it's $1 million a mile. So we have a lot of miles that aren't covered. It would be a massive investment.
Should we move on, Taylor, to I think the next topic, well, I'm just going to throw it out. We talked a little bit about this beforehand, but one of the things that's really critical that the commissioners do is manage the whole election process, for the county, which is everything from running the primaries, the machinery, training the people who are elected as judge and inspectors of elections, counting, doing the auditing, reporting that to the state. I mean, I'm just kind of giving like a broad brushstroke, but it's really, I think it's a place where, and I know Taylor and I have both worked with the Union County office and some of this with other offices. I mean, we have a stellar staff, and of all of the things that are out there in our culture right now that lead people to distrust government, the way that our county runs a very clean, just being the ref, you know, just being neutral, really stands out as giving me faith.
I truly think we have the best election staff in the region, hands down.
But we are in a context, and I might be edgier here than Taylor or Stacey are comfortable being, but we are in a context where it's clear to me that big players in the Republican Party especially see changing the way that elections happen as a key to holding on to power in the context of shrinking, of a shrinking demographic advantage for them. So, and they've been very explicit about this. So, you know, in that context, like what have been important things, and also Act 51 or whatever, which Act 50, which changed things in Pennsylvania.
77, I think it was.
Thank you. Act 77. So forgetting what I said about the concern, like up to now, like what are things that are sort of bullet points that you think have either gone well or even changes? Because Act 77 did bring a lot of changes to elections, regardless of partisanship.
It did. Yeah. And actually, I think that's probably one of the most important things that the county commissioners, along with the election staff, did in 2020 during COVID, and again in 2021, but particularly as COVID was hitting, because Act 77, which expanded a number of things, but it expanded the ability to vote early by mail-in ballots instead of just absentee ballots, and you could only do that under special circumstances. And then the investment in new voting machine technology the year before were real changes for the election staff. So the previous board of commissioners, as well as the election staff, and our first time to use the expanded ability to vote by mail happened a couple of weeks, 2 months after COVID hit. And I've got to say, thank goodness, because people were then be allowed to vote safely. But what it did is it set up because it's so popular, it's still popular, it really set up a two voting system, particularly on election day. You've got the people that went to the polls and voted by electronically, and then were not allowed by law to open up and count those mail-in ballots until election day. So there are two operations that are going on. So when COVID hit, I'm really glad I had experience in elections. You know, that helped me a lot. But
you're
saying
you had like a cycle of being a commissioner through 2019.
No. Both Jeff Reber and I were new to the commission. So the election board is made up of the three commissioners. Preston Boop had experience with it. But John Showers, who preceded me for years, had been chair of the election board. So fortunately, our election staff thought about it, knew what to do. One of my big concerns was, let's not by default, because of COVID and the risk of COVID, let's reduce the transparency of the election. We must make sure that it is still considered without any question to have been a very honest and open election. So that meant that at the polling locations, Granted, we didn't require mask wearing, but we had all sorts of safety elements embedded in that. But there's the big process during election day, as well as, you know, for the week after election, of observers observing both in, you know, in the polling places, as well as counting and opening and whatnot for the mail-in ballots. And that became a really big job. So how is it that we were able to keep people feeling safe and make some changes in how we executed those operations and have it work? So it took a lot of thought. And I'm really, really, really impressed with the election staff and what they did. But, you know, even now we're going back and taking a look at, okay, in time for the primary this year, you know, we're through this. Are there some improvements that we could make in our process? You know, can we be anticipating certain things that we hadn't anticipated before? Should we tweak this process or that process? Because the mail-in ballots end up being now through a couple of primaries or a couple of elections are clearly two Democrats to every one Republican are voting by mail-in ballot. That skews things. That means that we need to make sure that there's absolutely no bias at all in how those votes get tallied versus how the electronic votes get tallied. But mail-in ballots by their very process require handling by humans and in some instances decisions by humans. It's actually technically more difficult to correctly vote by mail-in than it is to go in and vote by machine.
I mean for a voter?
So yes.
But I think you're saying two things there. It's more complicated for the voter, but it's also more labor, right? And more possibilities of mistakes in the system on the counting side. Is that what you were trying to say?
Mistakes or, you know, not understanding the law. You know, there were a lot of changes that came
down. But also, or just purely labor. It takes more labor.
It does. It does. And we fortunately anticipated the labor. And the county commissioners were front and center for particularly the mail-in voting for all of the elections.
Were many ballots spoiled in the 2020, in the most recent election?
No, I think that there were about 18 about 18 that were naked ballots. They didn't include the security envelope, which just, it's thrown out. We post them on the window, and if a political party wants to try to follow up with that voter, because it happens on election day, they can't. That's still allowed. But, you know, we needed to work through, okay, there's information that you need to include on the outside of the envelope that gets mailed in. You know, are we going to accept that they put their birth date in instead of the date in which they filled out the ballot? Yes, we were. You know, those sorts of things needed to be worked through. But you know, we have to scan every one of those mail-in ballots. And the scanners spit some of them out. And so they need to be read by hand and interpreted by hand. You know, what's that process? What are the rules of the road? What will we accept? That's some of the handling that I'm talking about. It's not every ballot, but it's too many ballots when it's not a 50-50 split, you know, between the voters. It's really skewed to Democrats right now. Go ahead.
I just want to sort of step back a little bit to 500 feet sort of perspective, because partly because we're short on time, we could probably do a whole nother one on elections and how they happen. But like one thing that I think is important that for Americans is like, we're very used to.
Froze for me, Jordy.
Am I better now?
Yes.
So we're very used to things as Americans seeming very simple, right? Like we have a whole economy of like ordering food and everything. And if there's a mistake or whatever, it can be reversible. The thing about an election
I can see both of you fine. Unfortunately.
Yeah, that means.
Or fortunately.
Can you hear me now, Stacey?
Okay, Jordy. Now I can. Do that again.
Okay.
Simple. So. We're used to things being simple, and then.
And then an election happens, and suddenly. A little bit like COVID, everybody's an expert on like auditing election technology, intent and all of this. But it is a different process than ones we're used to, you know, because there isn't reversibility. Like that maybe that's so obvious, people, it doesn't need to be said, but I feel like people forget it. You know, if there's a mistake on your credit card bill, there's a mechanism. If there's an error in voting, it's one shot, right? And so to design a system that has close to zero errors for, I don't know, you know, 180 million Americans or however many vote, or 100 million Americans, 160, I think, voted in the last presidential. So we need to like both understand the process and also like, you know, I have a whole bunch of points about that, but that's just sort of a big piece. But what I wanted to say, that's just sort of context, but what I wanted to say about Act 77 was, you know, it was passed not because of COVID, and it had so many good things in it. Like having mail-in ballots compared to our old system, and I've voted in other states, maybe some of us have, where you had to, it basically felt like I had to bring a note from the doctor to explain why I was absentee. Mm-hmm. It was very heavy-handed, and the kind of government that I think Republicans don't like.
It used to be that way in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, in Pennsylvania. So mm-hmm. It got rid of that, and it was basically, you know, and it makes voting easier. I'm all for making voting easier, especially, and this is the thing, and I don't, you must have to deal with it way more than me, Stacey, but there continues to be this big lie that there's lots of voter fraud, and that drives the motivation of people who look skeptically at some of these changes. And I cannot say enough, because it has to be repeated, that, you know, we need a system that errs on the side of voter intent, because there is almost no voter fraud at the level of people changing their ballot. Election fraud happens a little more often. It's still very rare. But that's when, like in North Carolina, you have somebody going around circulating things. But your average voter does not intend to defraud, won't. And so the whole system, right, especially if we consider the right to vote as sacrosanct. You know, I got into this with Fred Keller, at the market, because he was just saying his vote decertifying the 2020 election result was because, you know, that the Secretary of State of Pennsylvania and the governor did things they weren't supposed to do. And I'm like, they were about interpreting rules. And fundamentally, maybe you disagreed with it. And by the way, you could have used the courts, but the right to vote is more important than the bureaucratic. They did, and they lost. The right to vote is more important than the bureaucratic rules about where the birth date goes, right? That's what gets missed in this. So that's what I wanted to say. I don't know if you have any responses, because I got on my soapbox, but that's what drives me crazy. And that's true for everybody, right?
It drives me crazy too.
We're protecting the right to vote of old Republicans and young Republicans too. I care about that as much. I know that some of them don't believe it, because out here, when we make it easier to vote and more people voting because of the numbers, we're usually helping Republicans. So when I speak out about this, it's not because I'm looking for a partisan advantage.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you, you and I have talked about this many times. Voter fraud, if voter fraud is happening, it's happening in the restrictions on the right to vote, and it's in so many ways, you know. And we don't even have to talk. We don't even have to talk about the past. I am very concerned about that poll, the polls that have come out that have said that more than 50%, well over more than 50% of Republicans believe that the election didn't go to Biden. You know, how could that possibly be? And I can tell you, as an election board member, and so can my colleagues, that our elections had no error. And it's great to know that they were so clean. And that we can do that. And plenty of counties do that. So that expansion, it's disappointing if the Federal Voting Act doesn't happen. The mischief that is coming down from the state is frightening. And we have conversations about it. We don't know what might happen. But the thing is that the county election team needs to follow the law. And the state legislature, if the federal government isn't going to supersede, they determine the law. So some of the proposals on the table are frightening. And I'm hoping that they don't come to pass, that they're simply frightening. But in this day and age of so many people believing the big lie, I worry very much about it. So hopefully on my watch, we still have open elections. They're as open as they could possibly be under good law, and people are not disenfranchised.
And I think all the work you do with Jeff Reber and Preston Boop to, you know, bridging differences, like that probably pays off in this, right? Because you all have a good working relationship. So it means when it comes down to saying we need to protect the election integrity, right? Like you've banked that. That's what it looks like to me as your constituent. I'll shut up because Taylor's trying to.
I do, but you know, I'm trusting based on what we did before that we can do it again. But when you have Fred Keller and Dave Rowe, our, you know, congressional and state reps believe in the big lie. And in the case of Keller, actually voting against certifying Pennsylvania's votes. Oh, my God. His own election results, although they only question, of course, the presidential. But it's just you worry about how deep is this machine and how deep does this go?
Yeah, I'm very much of two minds about this. Part of me thinks that sort of the Democratic backslide, small D Democratic backslide, is just the most concerning thing happening in America. And then part of me also thinks that, you know, the way in which voting is administered in the country is so fragmented that a lot of these laws are more bark than bite. But, you know, and I'll just second really quickly, and then I'll take it right to Jordy, who I think has one more question for you before we end the mm-hmm. We end the pod. But I'll just second that the only voter fraud that happens is the voter fraud that is ongoing, that disenfranchises people. We have all spent time knocking on doors and doing the work of you know, running for office or operating an election. And I know that I've hit you know, talked with a lot of people that are maybe immobile. You know, it's the election day. They can't get out, their vote won't count, they're excited, and they just didn't know there was a special election, or it snuck up on them and they didn't get their ballot in time, yada, yada, yada. It happens so much, and it's so discouraging to see. But I mm-hmm. love that framing, and I think it's absolutely true.
I mean, I'll also throw out this tidbit, because I think you said something, Stacey, that's super important, which is we have two ways to vote now, in person on election day and by mail-in ballot. And for different reasons, the people who elect to use that vary by party. I mean, A, fine, good, more ways to vote.
It's much more resilient system.
Yeah.
Mm, B, good point.
B, and this is me, you know, aiming at the media, which is something that, you know, maybe I have in common with some conservatives. It's the media and our culture that's obsessed with the idea that you're going to learn that night. Right.
Exactly.
And I'm just like, calm the fuck down, everybody. Sorry. Like, just wait. It's like a really good apple pie. You got to let it cook and bake. Just wait 2 or 3 days. And I think that the not canvassing the mail-in ballots the same day, I actually think that that's good. Like, I know it's frustrating because it can be a huge backlog in some places, but I think it's important because it would be hard. That information would start to leak. And if people know how an election is going, it affects how they vote. We know that from other research. So I think it's just better to count it all starting on that day. And if the whole process takes, I would rather wait a week and not know, right, than deal with this made up issue of like, well, we didn't learn by 11 o'clock news. I mean, which is the tail and which is the dog?
Oh, really, I so agree. And in fact, I think that any mail-in ballot should count as long as it has is postmarked, you know, that day, election
totally.
Day. And that then would extend it out that much more, you know, but to believe that the steal happened because of mail-in balloting and the muckety-mucking there and that,
right.
you know, the late count, baloney.
Right. And the last thing about
and
the
mail-ins. There's a lot kookier things than that that people believe.
But, well, you know, Oregon has had mail-in ballots for like 30 years. That's the only way to vote in Oregon. And there are some other examples.
Everybody gets a mail-in ballot in California.
But in terms of Oregon, mm-hmm. like the research tends to show, despite what we hope, that, you know, Oregon doesn't have like 20% higher participation rate than other states. Right. So like there tends to be a bump when you introduce mail-in ballots, and then it tends to regress back to kind of the average.
Yeah.
So all of these people on the Republican side who think that like the Democrats are locking it. And by the way, Act 77 was passed by the Republican state legislature, partly because it got rid of straight ticket voting, which mm-hmm. they loved. So it was their bill of voting reforms. Anyway, probably over time, those differences will even out. So it doesn't really, voting method does not seem, based on what we know from other places.
I did my political science bachelor's thesis on this, convenience voting, efficacy of convenience voting techniques. Yeah.
Mm.
Damn, I didn't know that.
We should talk.
So, Stacey, I'm going to give you a choice, right? Because we're kind of running out of time. So we had two kind of big questions. You can pick which one you want to do. One is, do you want to speak about like infrastructure and development and like speeding it up? Because this even came, speed up and making it cheaper, right? Overall infrastructure costs a lot.
Super expensive infrastructure in Pennsylvania or in the U.S. actually.
In the U.S. And like you were talking about, like you're just now getting the ARPA money And that's no fault of yours, of course. So that's one question. What can we do to make that whole process
more efficient,
faster and cheaper? Or do you want to talk about what you've learned about political polarization and what it looks like from your
perspective? Yeah. And we'll save the next one for the next pod.
Okay. Right. Well, I think we've already talked about the polarization. And I don't think I have much more to say about that, other than it's frightening. I very much worry about it. The militant partisanship that we have now is very scary. Not that we haven't had difficulties before in the country.
Civil war.
Can you hear me? Because you're frozen.
I can hear you.
War. But for the infrastructure, I think that you're going to find that I am disagreeing. And I'm showing that my internet is unstable. Am I coming in?
You're coming in. Yeah, totally.
Fine. Okay. So there we go. Infrastructure being unstable. having worked in the public works field, particularly transportation, but also other places, here in Pennsylvania, one of the reasons why it's so expensive is that back in the 70s, when the interstate system was being built, there was a lot of graft. And it used to be that you could have what's called a turnkey operation where a road was designed and it was built by the same firm. There was so much graft in having those contracts go to political cronies so that it was a shoddy job. It costs far more for Pennsylvania to build the interstate than was necessary because we needed at our cost to rebuild it. So the law was changed here so that always you need to have, you can select the engineer. It's a separate process. You can't have the two together anymore. You can select the engineer. The engineer puts together the bid documents, which can take time and are expensive. And then what was instituted that I'm not sure I always believe in is that then the bid documents, the construction part of it gets bid. And there's a requirement for, say, a public works job to accept the low bidder. And that, to me, is where you can still have shoddy work. But it's a two-part process here in Pennsylvania. It's one of the things that adds cost to capital works projects. But at the same time, what people most complain about is the payment of a prevailing wage, whether it's state prevailing wage or federal prevailing wage. And on a capital project, an infrastructure project of any site sort, if there's federal dollars, then the federal prevailing wage applies. If it's only state dollars and even a dime of it, then state prevailing wage laws apply. A lot of people feel a lot of ways about that cost. A lot of people say people in our area don't make that much money as state prevailing wage or federal prevailing wage requires employees to be paid. But why not? Maybe they should be, is how I view it. And somebody else is going to scream inflation, inflation, inflation.
I know, we're building a bathroom in Hufnagle Park in Lewisburg, and the price tag was $400,000 or something. And people were like, what the hell? Just hire. They were like, just hire some, Mennonites. I don't mean that to sound prejudiced at all. And part of me was like, look, that prevailing wage is actually a wage inflator for everybody in the area, and it puts the dollars back in the local economy. So, that's one thing to think about. The other, of course, with the bathroom is we had to create sewage and water lines.
Yeah, that's not a great example of a
In fact,
does
we did that pretty fast.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, there are I'm wearing a Swedish soccer jersey right now, but.
Sure, it's not your mass transit jersey.
Yeah, but if you look at the cost, like just for like to construct a mile of highway or a mile of rail, the U.S. pays the most. And I think it's a lot of people have talked about our the environmental review process is perhaps too onerous, or maybe it's too. Too easy to delay a project because of lawsuits that are around either environmental concerns or NIMBY concerns, and our infrastructure is just more expensive, and I don't think we have a very good idea of why that is. And I mean, some people have blamed unions and this whole idea of prevailing wage, and I mean, if it's cheaper, we don't have very strong union protections in the U.S. And a lot of European countries have very strong labor unions, and their the cost of building their infrastructure is much less. So, I mean, it's just a, it's, you know, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on the environmental review process?
I do. Okay. I do. And this goes back to my time in Boston in particular. Every day, because my job was to take it from the planning stage through the environmental review stage and the permitting stage so it could get into construction, with every day costing money if you didn't get into construction, there was a tremendous amount of pressure. But the deal that we did, I mean, some of it is how we do things. On that project, which ended up being a $14, $16 billion project, it was massive, putting tunnels under the city and the harbor and whatnot. It tripped every environmental law that there was. And we knew that. And there were 78 federal, state, and local agencies that I needed to negotiate with on a daily basis about how to do that. And we knew that we'd never get it done if we did it one agency at a time. So what we did for this is we used the National Environmental Policy Act, which sets up public engagement. And we said to the agencies and powerful community members, tell you what, we will engage you upfront in the studies, determining the studies, whatever it's going to take to support permits. And we will work with you every step of the way. But when it comes time to give permits, okay? Because that's where things can really get tied up. It took 6 years to get through that. But we weren't spending money and then unspending it. We didn't have to put certain things in play to be waiting and have it go ching, 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 ching every day. And I had plenty of construction workers on the project who I felt some days that I would walk down the hall and I was pulling imaginary knives out of my back because they were throwing them at me. They were very unhappy about these environmental laws. But the reality is, Boston is what Boston is, and we have Spectacle Island in the middle of that harbor that we put some contaminated dirt on, stopped a leaching landfill, and it now runs 100% on electricity. And it is an extraordinarily popular tourist site. And that's only one of the massive things that we did. And it was because of the environmental laws that things were better. Some of it is how we go about doing it. And I worked with PennDOT when I was at DEP, the head of environmental planning. And we actually speeded up the review process for permitting for roads because of requiring engineers to be more thorough and establishing a better process for being able to review things. And they won an award for it. You know, they won a national award for that. And then he went on to retire and teach it to other, secretaries of transportation in other states. So sometimes it's how we do it. And sometimes that can be fixed. I wouldn't get rid of a single environmental law because every single one of them is important. And I want to go back to, you know, prevailing wage. The difficulty with prevailing wage, as I see it, is that it does exclude some of the mom and pop construction firms who are not large enough to have the capacity to do the labor. You don't have to be a union. You just need to pay the prevailing wage. And there is more work in collecting that and making sure that that's right, but not that much more work. So could we do better? Yeah. But I would not see it being that we would necessarily reduce any of the laws. They're there for a very good reason. And we haven't had very many environmental laws passed since the 1960s and 70s. And we probably should. We could probably even do better. So I think we're probably over time. But I want to give you one more flip side of that. Taylor and Jordy, you know that I'm unhappy about the private sector deals in bringing utility scale solar into our county and putting it on our prime farmlands. That is a free for all. That is completely very little permitting and a completely a private sector deal between the landowner and the solar developers. That has so few safeguards in it that it takes completely out of the county's and to a certain extent out of the municipality's hands. anything having to do with land use. Well, agriculture is a very important part of our economy, as is tourism, and which has to do with the view sheds. So we will see a tipping point that will affect our economy locally when that money that is harvested from those solar fields is going into outside investors' pockets and not a dime is coming back. And in fact, we're losing local wealth creation and recirculation. So I'm really big about this, but that is an example of not much is being regulated. Just as Marcellus Shale, not much was regulated. And I do believe that great damage can be done.
The way you described it, it sort of sounded like the solar, it's like the CAFO, like the solar farms, it's like the CAFO of solar, solar farming.
Yeah, but even worse, because it's owned by outside investors. It's a massive land use change. You know,
most of the CAFO, they're just renting their land, and
just renting their land, but they are buying seed from there is a little bit of a support of the agricultural community. In this case with solar, there's none.
Right.
More of a Marcellus Shale fracking
2.0. It's a better comparison.
Fracking the sun.
Yeah. I mean, Stacey, I absolutely hear you. And this is when
when two infrastructure geeks start to go at it on a podcast.
Yeah, but
pop my popcorn.
This is when my climate sensibility is about, like, we need solar right now, you know, and I mean, it would take, you know, we need a mass mobilization to create so much more solar, you know, that side of me hits up with my, you know, agriculture, you know, what you said, agriculture is an incredible asset to our region. And it, you know, just putting, you know, throwing some solar panels up limits the productive use of that land for the lifetime.
It doesn't have to be on prime agricultural land. And also, you know, at the other end of it, we began this podcast with it, energy reduction and energy efficiency is very key to this equation. And the opportunity to be able to own and use solar isn't anywhere in our policy in Pennsylvania. So all of the pieces that could make this work and start there, you know, instead of the utility scale, they're gone. And there are really no levers to pull at the county level to get them back. And I believe it is it's verging on crime that our state government has, our Commonwealth and the leaders in the Commonwealth is just allowing this to happen. I'd love to have a podcast on this issue alone because there's a lot to talk about it.
I would too. I mean, I told Taylor three times now in the private chat to not let me talk more, but you know, what you're describing is like one more chapter in Pennsylvania's history as the extractor.
Yes. You're absolutely right. I hate to end
I
on
never
that
hear
sad
that.
Well, yeah, that's not a sad note. Jordy, you're absolutely right. And so are you, Taylor. And you probably want to wrap up. But before you do, I want to thank you so much. I always love talking to you. I really appreciate this opportunity
to
talk about these things.
It is absolutely our pleasure. We're so lucky to have somebody with your breadth of experience as a county commissioner. And, you know, we're just so thankful for you to take the time to come and speak with us.
Anytime.
Ditto.
Thank you so much.
How can people stay in touch with you? Do you have any sort of social media feed or a newsletter or something like that people could reach out to you on?
The best is by phone, and it's really probably to call my office. I do have a Facebook, but I you know, I don't use it.
Yeah.
So my phone
speaking from
number,
experience, don't use that.
Yeah, Facebook's for suckers.
My phone number is easily accessible, but I'm happy to give it. It's 570-524-8640. And I do.
Well, the
listener
will appreciate that.
I hope so. And also to show up at our commissioner work sessions. I'm disappointed in the number of people that come. We have every month, the first Tuesday of the month at 2:20. We have an election board meeting, you're interested in the elections, we could talk about anything there, even if we have no action to take. But we have work sessions every Tuesday from 10 to at least 11, and then public meetings where we take action on things that are discussed in the work session, the first and third Tuesday of every month at 2 o'clock. I'd love to see more engagement by the public, because an informed public really is the underpinning of a good democracy.
Well, we'll end it on that note. Thank you so much.
Thank you. See you soon. I hope. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Waterloo, Lackawanna, Fairview, Bellevue, Sweet Roots, Susquehanna, Lewisburg, Stroudsburg, Gillysburg, Orbisonia, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, Wellesburg, Robsonia, Mountaintop, Glen Rock, Flat Rock, Sunbury, St. Mary, Shick, Shanny, Big Shanny, I'm a dandy. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Belfont, Southmont, Westmont, Wilmersdorf, Nordmont, Dormont, Lebanon, Holmesworth, Cedar Springs, Bowling Springs, Chess Springs, Centerbridge, Centersport, Leesport, Williamsport, Brackenridge, Lumber City, Central City, Lake City, Clearfield, Westfield, Wentfield, Richfield, big deal. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. I've been the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.